We have four young Raiders who are going to join us today. And before we do anything, I'd like them to each introduce themselves to you. If you could please let us know your name, where you are in life, what grade you're going into, or what you'll be doing in the fall. This is also a great time to offer any shout-outs, if you have any. Just so folks have a sense of who's in the room. And we'll just go right around, starting with Ori.
All right. I'm Ori Golden. I'm 18 years old. This fall, I'll be studying politics and economics at Charles University in the Czech Republic. I'd like to give a couple shout-outs to my English teachers, Mr. Ayers and Mrs. Green at Fox Chapel Area High School. And I'm very happy to be here and to share my writing.
Great. Have you been to Prague yet or the Czech Republic?
No, I'm essentially going in blind, but I'm very excited to see what the city has to offer.
That's exciting. And I've mentioned it on the air a few times. I've been to Prague once for a long – it was a bit ago, but it was a beautiful city. I think it still is, and a lot there to offer. I'm assuming the university is in Prague.
Yes. Yeah.
Since it's Charles, and I think of the Charles Bridge. Well, it's nice to meet you, and let's see, Zoe, you're next.
Hi, I'm Zoe Cassie. I'm 17 years old, and next year I will be going to Susquehanna University to study creative writing. And I'd like to shout out my parents for supporting me through all this.
Hi, my name is Juliet Marinelli. I'm 13 years old. I'm going into eighth grade. And I'll shout out Miss Morris, my goal teacher, who introduced me to scholastic writing.
Excellent. And then finally.
Hi, I'm Lula Petty. I am 16, going into 11th grade this fall. Where I am in life right now is pretty good. I'm taking a Western Civilizations class right now. It's super interesting. And I'm taking two art classes this year, which is super exciting for me.
That's great. What are your art classes?
One of them is Studio Art 2, which is just a bunch of different arts put together in a kind of interesting sequence. And then my second one is painting, which is exploring different types of painting, like oil painting, watercolor, a bunch of different avenues.
That's great. So one thing I was mentioning about things we have in common, all of you, I think, are pretty passionate about writing and about self-expression and getting your writing out there. And let's talk a little bit about why writing matters to each of you personally and in general, too. And anybody, please hop in if you want to just share a thought about that.
For me, writing has always been a way to express myself in a very healthy way, because there are a lot of unhealthy ways to express yourself. And I think that writing, even if it's something that could be controversial or negative, it's just a lot better than the other things you see people doing.
That's a really good observation. That was Lula. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. This is Ori. In all honesty, writing and art don't take up a majority of my extracurricular time. Mostly it's taken up by civics, economics, the social sciences. But I like to think about and do writing because those civics and legal systems, they're built by people overcoming immense social challenges, experiencing immense emotions, going through conflicts. And I think that writing is a great way to express what those conflicts are.
Excellent. And any other thoughts?
Yeah, this is Zoe. I have always loved writing because even before I loved writing, I loved reading, and I am still a voracious reader, and I wanted to be able to have other people feel what I felt when I read a book, and I wanted to share my joy for reading with other people by creating these books that are so cool to me. So.
That is a great observation, and one I don't think I've ever heard expressed quite that way before. I do think if you're going to write, reading is a good thing to get better at. What about you, Juliet?
I think writing is important because it, like, not only can make people feel things, it can, like, change people's minds and make them, like, think from a different perspective. And I think that, like, reading or writing from different point of views is important to, like, achieve, like, a perspective of, like, the world. Like, kind of to, like, it, like, helps me to understand, like, other people. And, yeah.
That's similar to what Ori mentioned. If not persuasive, just writing to at least open people's minds and help them understand things. Those are such interesting reasons, and there are so many reasons that people feel writing is important. Now, I want to be sure that each of you has a chance to share work today. And Juliet was going to start. What did you bring today?
I wrote a short story called Grace. It's about a girl with lymphoma, written from both the perspective of the girl and her doctor.
Well, whenever you're ready, please share away.
Okay. One thing is certain. There is a light at both ends of this familiar path. I just don't know which way I am walking. The faint whine of a construction front loader reminds me of another world. Dull white walls, an urgently beeping heart monitor, whispers of an unpronounceable, ugly disease. But they were only whispers until Dr. Conlin, a king among his strictly disinfected kingdom, declared it to be real, quick, unfamiliar syllables dripping from his tongue. I am close now to something. I can feel it, in the wail of the wind, in the thump-thumping of my heart. I turn my face to the gray sky, and I can see them, waiting for me, watching me. Grandparents, aunts, uncles, the old striped cat, the easygoing arthritic dog. Hurry up, they tell me urgently, but with an excited urgency, like the feeling you get on Christmas Eve, when you can't sleep but you know you should, when the giddy warmth explodes out of you in eager waves. I still felt that giddy warmth every season, even after a year of being stuck in white walls and the sickly smell of disinfectant and cleaning spray, and not just because the nurses brought me a stocking. I will, I whisper back, beaming as they smile down at me like warm rays of sunshine. I'm coming. Suddenly, the sun does burst out of the cold gray clouds, warming my neck and hands just enough to make me smile. A prissity, I think to myself, smirking secretly. The warmth of a winter sun. The perfect word for a perfect meaning. Warmth in the cold, peace in the chaos, good in the bad. Brenda, my favorite nurse, taught me that one. You never know when you could use a little bit of warmth on a cold winter's day, she told me with a wink, and slipped me a fun-sized Twix bar. Although it wasn't winter yet, was it? I turn onto a street I've known since I could walk across it, the place where I learned to bicycle, to play kickball, to climb trees. I can see it, in the distance, a cozy little blot on the crest of a sloping green hill. Home. I break into a run, my hair flying behind me, my face split in a smile. The wind is whistling down my throat. It is in me, swirling around me, lifting me up with a wonderful swooping sensation in my stomach, higher and higher until my feet leave the ground like I have wings on my ankles. I spread my arms at the crest of the hill and soar into silence. Dr. Conlin. I know that I could do nothing else to save the poor girl, and yet there is so much I could have done, that I will do. Every life taken is a lesson learned. Every failure is a chance to try again. But Grace Ackerman did not deserve to die. Grace Ackerman was sweet and polite and innocent, and no matter how much a lost life could mean, it is still just that, a life. A life cut short because of me. I force myself not to look at Grace's bed. There isn't time for this. There are so many more, so many to save. Besides, it is the same Grace I grew to love. Dark, curly brown hair, sky blue eyes, a face covered in freckles. I have killed her. I have failed, and she is dead. On top of that, I have provided her last months with nothing but a hospital room with hospital walls, hospital floors, and a hospital bed. Grace Ackerman will never get to grow up, and I hadn't even let her be a kid. The tears come, first slowly, then a rush of swollen eyes and cheap tissues, and I let the treacherous little drops of grief trickle down my face because I am the only living soul in the room. I step away from Grace's body, feeling as if my chest has been ripped in two. I need to get to work. There are so many others I cannot let die. I have the lives of children like Grace in my hands. I refuse to fail them as I failed her. Grace's pale eyes are empty, but there is a knowing grin etched on her face, like she can see something just above her that no one else can see. In her last moments, Grace Ackerman was smiling. I realize, as the hospital room fills with sunlight from the brilliant new sun, that I have not killed this incredible child. I have set her free.
Wow, that was amazing. That was Grace, who is 13 and about to enter eighth grade at Carson Middle School. Any comments for her? I'm kind of blown away by how connected I felt to both the doctor and to Grace.
Yeah, that was awesome. I really enjoyed hearing Colin?
Collins.
Yeah, Dr. Collins expression of like grief. I think it was a really good representation of how doctors who can't save a patient feel, especially pediatric doctors, because I could never do that. I'd feel terrible.
That was Lula. Any other comments that either of you would like to share?
I mean, it was incredible. I was almost crying by the end because, I mean, I knew what was coming, but I didn't want it to be true. It's sort of like, wait, no, maybe she's not dead. But I thought it was interesting, the idea that death set her free from a life that wasn't really a life. Like the doctor said, like she had a whole life to live, but while she was still alive, she hadn't actually been living. So it was an interesting tool to use death as both like what it is, like an ending of a life, but also like a way to set someone free. So.
And Ori, any thoughts from you before you share your own work?
Yeah, of course. I thought that your description of the setting was really interesting. I especially enjoyed hearing the repetition of the word hospital walls, hospital ceiling, just that very clinical, sanitized description of the surrounding.
Yeah, that drew me in, especially just in the first paragraph or two that you read. I immediately felt like I was there. Well done, Juliet.
Thank you.
And next is Ori. And Ori, what do you have?
I have a short story that I called A Way Out. It takes place in New York City during the 1830s or 1840s. And it has themes of the abolitionist period. All right. A gentle, dirtied hand took hold of a cold beer glass. The hand pulled the glass out of the icebox and set it down carefully on a countertop. As she put down the glass, Judith felt a greasy smear on her palm and wiped it on a wet towel that hung nearby. Though she was unsatisfied with the still oily result, the young woman moved on. Judith left the little room and carried the glass over to a keg at the back bar. She let a stream of watered-down beer fill to the brim. Judith placed the drink in front of a man who hadn't seen youth in many years, but who was quite engrossed in the pocket Bible that he held near his stern and golden face. Once the man took notice of Judith, his eyes went wide. He frantically pulled out a pocket watch, glared at it, made a remark along the lines of crap, and shot up the stairs of the tavern, out into the street. "Didn't even pay," muttered Judith, as she set aside the drink and wiped away the stains on the bar. She set to cleaning glasses. Soon after, another customer came down the steps. Absentmindedly, Judith greeted him. "A good evening to you too, ma'am," answered a set of black lips. Unused to hearing that particular accent in New York, Judith looked up, only slightly startled. A man in loose-fitting clothes sat down at the bar. His eyes dashed back and forth every few moments, a layer of fear thinner than paper but as obvious as a missing arm covered every inch of his skin. He was a runaway, Judith saw that much. The man clutched something in his hand. He produced the thing, a 5-cent piece. "Please, may I have a drink, ma'am?" he asked. The layer of fear stayed there, across his dark face, not growing thicker nor thinner, but there, in every living moment, in each syllable of his voice. Judith began to stare, but something fell into place and she took the nickel. She picked up the beer from earlier, still cold. Judith placed it atop the bar, directly between her and the runaway. The man placed both hands around the glass. He kept his palms there for a moment before lifting up the drink and taking one deep swig. He set it down again. The layer of fear lifted away but returned soon after. The runaway continued to sip slowly, always with both hands. Judith went on washing dishes at the bar. Two shapes came down the steps. Absentmindedly, Judith greeted them. "Good evening, miss," said the first. Silent was the second. The two stopped halfway between the last step and the bar. One saw the black man and developed a sinister grin. One shape found its way onto each of the seats on either side of the runaway. The man looked up from his empty glass. His eyes looked blankly toward the back bar, flowing over sparkling bottles of golden ichor. Judith glared. "Do I know you?" asked the first shape. The runaway's dark lips did not move. The shape looked down at the man's hands, which still clenched the beer glass madly. A bony white hand peeled back the runaway's fingers and ran over his calloused, scarred palm. "Oh, yes, I do," a pair of lips answered. A white face looked up at Judith. "Would you be so kind as to bring each of us a drink?"
Wow, that is another one that just takes you in, and in your case, not only to another place, but another time, and how you chose to end. Was that the end of the story, or did you choose to end at a good stopping point?
I did choose to end at a good stopping point. There's one more page with a little fun little ending, but I don't know if we have time for that.
Well, it's probably that was a good choice. I want to be sure. And thank you for being so respectful of everybody else here. You still picked a good place for it to stop. Any thoughts? I mean, going to that time of abolitionist time is a really refreshing, I guess, to hear a story from somebody writing something fictitious with that time.
This is Lula. That was, first off, that was great. A few things definitely stuck out to me. When you said "always with both hands" when he was referring to his beer glass, that immediately stuck out to me because it's not just representative of the beer glass, obviously. It has a much deeper meaning of, like, he feels as though he has to hold on to everything he has with both hands, otherwise it'll slip out of his grip. And I think it was, like, just a great expression of how lonesome it can be to be, like, the only black person, well, not the only black person, but one of the very few black people who is free and in a northern state. And you also said, not getting any thicker, but not thinner either, referring to his fear, very powerful. Because sometimes fear does feel stagnant. It doesn't feel like it's fluctuating. Very powerful. Great, great piece.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is Zoe. To add on to that, with the holding onto the glass with two hands, the way that in the end it wasn't enough, like his hands were still pulled back, I feel like that was also, like, an interesting thing. And then, I don't know if this was intentional, but Judith is her name, right? When she has the grease spot on her palm and she, like, can't wipe it off, that really reminded me of Macbeth, like the play with where Lady Macbeth is, like, out damn spot when she's trying to wipe off the blood off of her hand and can't wipe it off, and, like, as a sign of, like, her guilt. And it makes me wonder, like, what Judith is complicit in and why she feels that guilt.
That's so deep. Sorry, that was so deep.
Ori, was that your intention?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Congratulations. Juliet, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I really liked the beginning where you were introducing the setting. It, like, really, like, pulled you into the story. And I like where you chose to end it because, like, it's a, like, it makes you wonder what will happen next.
Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Ori. And before we still are going to hear from Lula with a poem and from Zoe. And now, as we approach the top of the hour, I can be sure that we're not interrupted. If you're just joining us, we have four students with us who are sharing writing honored by the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards. And up next with a poem is Lula. And Lula, is there anything you need to set up this poem or tell us about?
Yeah, so this poem was written about a year ago, and I think I have obviously changed as a person, but I want to use that to kind of say, like, regardless of how much you change something, like, you should always remember that you felt that way in a time, and it still matters and it's still relevant. So I'm going to read Dawn is the Color of My Soul. Shades of pink, yellow, and purple, dawn is the color of my soul. Pink is my compassion, my inspiration. She softens my soul, giving me love that is as deep as the rolling sea, the sea that I long to be a part of. She smells like a soft summer day, hovering over my life with a sweet air. She's a camellia, light and gentle, making all who see her pause in awe. My camellia is passionate. She blooms with beauty. My soul blooms with her. Pink is summer. Dawn starts early and unafraid. The sun climbs high in the sky. She is powerful and abundant. Encompassing all, pink is the color of my soul. Yellow is my hope, my creativity. She brightens my soul, giving me a vibrance that shines brighter than the sweltering sun, the sun that I long to stand under forevermore. She smells earthy, like a rich vanilla, bringing warmth that rivals the raging fires of life. She's a sunflower, rough and rounded, standing tall and proud. My sunflower is loyal. She's an emblem of happiness, a happiness that can only come from within. Yellow is fall. Dawn pulls away, making room for the night. The moon sits mellow with the sun in the early morning. She is balanced and prepared. Balancing energy, yellow is the color of my soul. Purple is my ambition, my fantasy. She mystifies my soul, giving me an independence that is louder than the howling wind, the wind that I long to fly away with. She smells like a brief breeze, the kind that passes too quickly, leaving a mysterious sweetness. She is an iris, sharp and intricate, keeping secrets close. My iris is valorant. She stands brave in the face of all danger, protecting me from the world that seems so far away. Purple is winter. Dawn is quiet and slow, yielding to the night for just a little longer. She is triumphant and renewed, powerful and royal. Purple is the color of my soul. Shades of pink, yellow, and purple, each being a vital part of me, dawn is the color of my soul.
Bravo. That was amazing, Zoe. It looks like you already wanted to mention something.
Oh, yeah. That was incredible, first of all. I really liked how you followed, like, a set pattern with each color, and that was, like, very obvious, but it was so well done because you didn't just copy and paste. Like, you were still able to give each color its own feeling and its own mood, and then also, like, the way that, like, especially with pink, I noticed it, you had all of your descriptors, it was almost like up above the world, and like you said, like you want to join the ocean, and then I know for purple you said you want to like join the wind, and so there's this sense of like the sun, the dawn is still the sky above the earth, so there's still this sense of distance, but also like you can feel the longing to join the earth, and all the emotions just came out really well, and it was really good.
Thank you.
I also think that the way you gave each color like a smell and like you could like really like feel like the emotion behind the color. I thought that was really cool how you like made a color like almost like something that you can like feel and like touch and like sense. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, I really enjoyed listening to that. I'm sure each of us has at some point seen a beautiful sunrise or a beautiful sunset, and I think you did a really great job describing what the feeling of seeing that is and thinking about what all the colors or all the elements of that kind of nature can mean.
It's beautifully done. I thought about your mentioning your love of art and your working on visual art, and I liked the colors that you happened to choose. Too. Those are not necessarily, well, they're your colors. They're the ones you chose. Well done. We've got one more work to share this morning, and that's from Zoe, who is a student at Pittsburgh Alderdice. And Zoe, you just graduated.
Yeah.
And what do you have to share today?
So I have a short story called The Meeting. I wrote this also about a year ago, and it's basically centered around the idea of what if the female gods from Greek mythology sort of revolted against this patriarchal society that they had been created in and that they were stuck in within their mythology. So it's a lot of Greek mythology references, so sorry in advance if you don't get all of them. Some of them are a little niche, my bad, but it's centered around the goddesses. And what I really wanted to focus on when I was writing it was not changing them to make them more feminist or less feminist to suit my purposes. I really wanted to try and keep the heart of the goddesses from when they were written and how they would react to, like, this idea of rebellion and a more modern time. The meeting took place in the women's quarters, as such meetings often do. No man would deign to venture into the dark, twisting halls. They were lazy predators, much preferring their prey to come to them. Only when a skirt was in reach would they try to get under it. Try being a bit of a misnomer, because men got what they wanted. The meeting took place out of time, a trick Rhea had picked up from her husband. No one knew, because no one had cared to ask, but Rhea had learned many things, not just how to be a wife and mother. Given that she wasn't great at those last two, it was a bit insulting that they should be deemed the extent of her abilities. But wasn't that why the muses had called the meeting? Sing, O muse, this, sing, O muse, that, the muses had gotten tired of the demands and restrictions of men. And besides, inspiring a revolution against the ingrained patriarchal and misogynistic hierarchy of the gods was much easier than inspiring some old man who thought he was a poet to actually listen for once. They had convinced a number of guests to come, including Eris, who was contrary by nature, Psyche, who was surprisingly easy, the human spirit often agrees with strife, and Athena, who was stubborn, never agreed with Eris, and was such a daddy's girl. Alecto, unceasing anger, friend of Nemesis, moves to the end of the room where the muses have set up a kind of podium elevated slightly. Alecto has not prepared a speech. She's not Calliope or Euterpe or anyone who would know how to talk to an audience. But she is angry. She sends it rolling off her skin and feels the answering waves of frustration. They know there is something wrong, even if they do not know what it is. Alecto smiles. I do not need to speak to you of anger. Demeter knows anger. She knows how it drives you, feeds you, burns you. She knows the power of it. She used it once before for her daughter. They did not believe she would, thought her too weak to protest. She was stronger than even she imagined. In a way, it has brought her closer to Aphrodite, though she does not care for some of the fashion advice this new relationship brings. She understands the anger boiling under Aphrodite's skin, the companion to constant love. Zeus feared this love, this anger. So Demeter accepted the invitation to the meeting, and she brought her daughter with her. Spring will come early this year. I do not need to speak to you of anger. I can feel it in you. Every invitation was accepted. We know it is time. It is time to fight back. It is time to rise up. It is time to remember who we are. Artemis has always known who she is. From the second she was born, she was midwife and protector to her young mother. She was born at night in the wild and simply never left. Protector, wildling. She has watched as men encroach on her territory, the impetuousness of it all. But she still had her hunters, her forests, her stars. So she did not care about what happened by marble and brick. She faded, by choice, beyond the eyes of men. But she is a huntress, and perhaps it is time the men remember why they feared the wild. Sing, O muse of a wronged and angry woman. She will be singing for a long time.
That was amazing. Everyone's amazing. That's the first word that comes to mind, and I want to jump right over to Lula, who I know has, I can tell, you're such a good listener, and as you take in these stories.
Yeah.
And poem.
Yeah, I was taking notes while listening to this, because it was just like, there. I already knew before she even started reading that I was going to be like, oh yeah, clock that. But you said a lot of things, not just how to be a wife and mother, referring to, I can't remember.
Rhea, Cronus's wife, yeah.
Yeah. I think that is so powerful because a lot of times people forget that the Greek goddesses weren't just like, they weren't just like, Aphrodite is always associated with being so beautiful and the goddess of love, but she's also the god of like wrath. Mm-hmm. Like she's very angry, and a lot of her stories kind of get disregarded as just being like, she's just a temptress, she seduces men. Which leads into like my next thing with Demeter. You said she brought her daughter with her. So powerful, just because like there's this TikTok thing that I saw, and it's like, this earth is just full of mothers and their children. So I think that Demeter bringing her daughter with her is such a good representation of like familial connections and how much like this isn't just a project for one person. This rebellion isn't just reliant on the individual, but it's like a team effort, a family effort. And you said by choice. She stayed out of society and away from men by choice when referring to Artemis, which like, yes, like, yes. People all like, by choice. Like, we're single by choice. We choose to do these things by choice. So, yeah, great, great references, great writing, great messages. Loved it. Loved it.
Thank you, Lula. Chalian, any thoughts?
I really liked your ending where it's like they will be singing for a long time. I thought that was like really powerful because like we have been singing for a long time, and it's like fighting for like women's rights and like patriarchy and stuff, and I think it was a really cool story.
Especially through the ancient gods, to express it that way. Ori?
Yeah, I found it really fun how you included a bit of bittersweet humor at times. I think I thought of a lot of connections to other similar situations. Of course, a very common way that people going through hardship bond with each other and get through those hardships is through humor, as I'm sure we have at times. So I think it's really realistic and powerful that you added in a bit of humor, that these people, they're going through hardship, they're going through difficult times, they're entering what seems to be a conflict that may not end soon, but they're trying to get through it through the use of humor.
Thanks to each of you. How remarkable. A poem, a contemporary narrative, a bit of historic fiction, and then a work that picks up from the gods and causes us to think a little bit about the times we're in. Thank you to Zoe, Ori, Juliet, and Lula.